Chapter 40. A thumbprint, and what came of it. We were approaching Napoleon, Arkansas. So I began to think about my errand there. Time, noonday, and bright and sunny. This was bad, not best, anyway, for mine was not, preferably, a noonday kind of errand. The more I thought, the more that fact pushed itself upon me, now in one form, now in another. Finally, it took the form of a distinct question. Is it good common sense to do the errand in daytime, when, by a little sacrifice of comfort and inclination, you can have night for it, and no inquisitive eyes around? This settled it. Plain question and plain answer make the shortest road out of most perplexities. I got my friends into my stateroom, and said I was sorry to create annoyance and disappointment, but that upon reflection it really seemed best that we put our luggage ashore and stop over at Napoleon. Their disapproval was prompt and loud, their language mutinous. Their main argument was one which has always been the first, to come to the surface, in such cases, since the beginning of time. But you decided and agreed to stick to this boat, etc., semicolon, as if, having determined to do an unwise thing, one is thereby bound to go ahead, and make two unwise things of it, by carrying out that determination. I tried various mollifying tactics upon them, with reasonably good success. Under which encouragement, I increased my efforts, and, to show them, that I had not created this annoying errand, and was in no way to blame for it, I presently drifted into its history substantially as follows. Toward the end of last year, I spent a few months in Munich, Bavaria. In November I was living in Fräulein Dahlweiner's pension, 1A, Karlstrasse. But my working quarters were a mile from there, in the house of a widow who supported herself by taking lodgers. She and her two young children used to drop in every morning and talk German to me by request. One day, during a ramble about the city, I visited one of the two establishments, where the government keeps and watches corpses until the doctors decide that they are permanently dead, and not in a trance state. It was a grisly place, that spacious room. There were 36 corpses of adults in sight, stretched on their backs on slightly slanted boards, in three long rows, all of them with wax-white, rigid faces, and all of them wrapped in white shrouds. Along the sides of the room were deep alcoves, like bay windows, and in each of these lay several marble-visaged babes, utterly hidden and buried under banks of fresh flowers, all but their faces and crossed hands. Around a finger of each of these 50 still forms, both great and small, was a ring, and from the ring a wire led to the ceiling, and thence to a bell in a watchroom yonder, where, day and night, a watchman sits always alert and ready to spring to the aid of any of that pallid company who, waking out of death, shall make a movement for any, even the slightest, movement will twitch the wire and ring that fearful bell. I imagined myself a death sentinel drowsing there alone far in the dragging watches of some wailing, gusty night, and having in a twinkling all my body stricken to quivering jelly by the sudden clamor of that awful summons. So I inquired about this thing, asked what resulted usually, if the watchman died, and the restored corpse came, and did what it could to make his last moments easy. But I was rebuked for trying to feed an idle and frivolous curiosity in so solemn, and so mournful a place, and went my way with a humbled crest. Next morning I was telling the widow my adventure, when she exclaimed, "Come with me. I have a lodger who shall tell you all you want to know. He has been a night watchman there." He was a living man, but he did not look it. He was abed, and had his head propped high on pillows. His face was wasted and colorless, his deep sunken eyes were shut, his hand, lying on his breast, was talon-like, it was so bony and long-fingered. The widow began her introduction of me. The man's eyes opened slowly, and glittered wickedly out from the twilight of their caverns. He frowned a black frown, he lifted his lean hand, and waved us peremptorily away. But the widow kept straight on, till she had got out the fact that I was a stranger and an American. The man's face changed at once, brightened, became even eager, and the next moment he and I were alone together. I opened up in cast iron German. He responded in quite flexible English. Thereafter we gave the German language a permanent rest. This consumptive and I became good friends. I visited him every day, and we talked about everything. At least, about everything but wives and children. Let anybody's wife or anybody's child be mentioned, and three things always followed. The most gracious and loving and tender light glimmered in the man's eyes for a moment, faded out the next, and in its place came that deadly look which had flamed there the first time I ever saw his lids unclose. Thirdly, he ceased from speech, there and then for that day, lay silent, abstracted, and absorbed, apparently heard nothing that I said, took no notice of my goodbyes, and plainly did not know, by either sight or hearing, when I left the room. When I had been this Carl Ritter's daily and sole intimate during 2 months, he one day said, abruptly, I will tell you my story. A dying man's confession, then he went on as follows. I have never given up, until now. But now I have given up. I am going to die. I made up my mind last night, that it must be, and very soon too. You say you are going to revisit your river, by and by, when you find opportunity. Very well, that, together with a certain strange experience which fell to my lot last night, determines me to tell you my history, for you will see Napoleon, Arkansas. And for my sake you will stop there, and do a certain thing for me, a thing which you will willingly undertake after you shall have heard my narrative. Let us shorten the story wherever we can, for it will need it, being long. You already know how I came to go to America, and how I came to settle in that lonely region in the South. But you do not know that I had a wife. My wife was young, beautiful, loving, and oh, so divinely good and blameless and gentle. And our little girl was her mother in miniature. It was the happiest of happy households. One night, it was toward the close of the war, I woke up out of a sodden lethargy, and found myself bound and gagged, and the air tainted with chloroform. I saw two men in the room, and one was saying to the other, in a hoarse whisper, I told her I would, if she made a noise, and as for the child, the other man interrupted in a low, half-crying voice, you said we'd only gag them and drop them, not hurt them, or I wouldn't have come. Shut up your whining, had to change the plan when they waked up. You done all you could to protect them, now let that satisfy you. Come, help rummage. Both men were masked, and wore coarse, ragged nigger clothes. They had a bull's-eye lantern, and by its light I noticed that the gentler robber had no thumb on his right hand. They rummaged around my poor cabin for a moment. The head bandit then said, in his stage whisper, it's a waste of time, he shall tell where it's hid. Undo his gag, and revive him up. The other said, all right, provided no clubbing. No clubbing it is, then, provided he keeps still. They approached me. Just then there was a sound outside. A sound of voices and trampling hoofs. The robbers held their breath and listened. The sounds came slowly nearer and nearer. Then came a shout, hello, the house. Show a light, we want water. The captain's voice, by G. Said the stage whispering ruffian, and both robbers fled by the way of the back door, shutting off their bullseye as they ran. The strangers shouted several times more, then rode by there seemed to be a dozen of the horses, and I heard nothing more. I struggled, but could not free myself from my bonds. I tried to speak, but the gag was effective. I could not make a sound. I listened for my wife's voice, and my child's listened long and intently, but no sound came from the other end of the room where their bed was. This silence became more and more awful, more and more ominous, every moment. Could you have endured an hour of it, do you think? pity me, then, who had to endure 3 hours? It was 3 ages. Whenever the clock struck, it seemed as if years had gone by since I had heard it last. All this time I was struggling in my bonds, and at last, about dawn, I got myself free, and rose up, and stretched my stiff limbs. I was able to distinguish the tales pretty well. The floor was littered with things thrown there by the robbers during their search for my savings. The first object that caught my particular attention was a document of mine which I had seen the rougher of the two ruffians glance at, and then cast away. It had blood on it. I staggered to the other end of the room. Oh, poor unoffending helpless ones, there they lay, their troubles ended, mine begun. Did I appeal to the law? Does it quench the pauper's thirst, if the king drink for him? Oh, no, 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 I wanted no impertinent interference of the law. Laws and the gallows could not pay the debt that was owing to me. Let the laws leave the matter in my hands, and have no fears. I would find the debtor and collect the debt. How accomplish this, do you say? How accomplish it, and feel so sure about it, when I had neither seen the robbers' faces, nor heard their natural voices, nor had any idea who they might be? Nevertheless, I was sure, quite confident. I had a clue which you would not have valued, a clue which would not have greatly helped even a detective, since he would lack the secret of how to apply it. I shall come to that. Presently you shall see. Let us go on, now, taking things in their due order. There was one circumstance which gave me a slant in a definite direction to begin with. Those two robbers were manifestly soldiers in tramp disguise, and not new to military service, but old in it regulars, perhaps. They did not acquire their soldierly attitude, gestures, carriage, in a day, nor a month, nor yet in a year. So I thought, but said nothing. And one of them had said, the captain's voice, by G ... the one whose life I would have. 2 miles away, several regiments were in camp, and 2 companies of U. SS cavalry. When I learned that Captain Blakely, of Company C, had passed our way, that night, with an escort, I said nothing, but in that company I resolved to seek my man. In conversation I studiously and persistently described the robbers as tramps, camp followers, and among this class the people made useless search, none suspecting the soldiers but me. Working patiently, by night, in my desolated home, I made a disguise for myself out of various odds and ends of clothing. In the nearest village I bought a pair of blue goggles. By and by, when the military camp broke up, and Company C was ordered 100 miles north, to Napoleon, I secreted my small hoard of money in my belt, and took my departure in the night. When Company C arrived in Napoleon, I was already there. Yes, I was there, with a new trade fortune teller. Not to seem partial, I made friends and told fortunes among all the company's garrisoned there, but I gave Company C the great bulk of my attentions. I made myself limitlessly obliging to these particular men. They could ask me no favor, put upon me no risk, which I would decline. I became the willing butt of their jokes. This perfected my popularity. I became a favorite. I early found a private who lacked a thumb. What joy it was to me. And when I found that he alone, of all the company, had lost a thumb, my last misgiving vanished. I was sure I was on the right track. This man's name was Kruger, a German. There were 9 Germans in the company. I watched, to see who might be his intimates. But he seemed to have no special intimates. But I was his intimate, and I took care to make the intimacy grow. Sometimes I so hungered for my revenge that I could hardly restrain myself from going on my knees and begging him to point out the man who had murdered my wife and child. But I managed to bridle my tongue. I bided my time, and went on telling fortunes as opportunity offered. My apparatus was simple. A little red paint and a bit of white paper. I painted the ball of the client's thumb, took a print of it on the paper, studied it that night, and revealed his fortune to him next day. What was my idea in this nonsense? It was this. When I was a youth, I knew an old Frenchman who had been a prison keeper for 30 years, and he told me that there was one thing about a person which never changed. From the cradle to the grave, the lines in the ball of the thumb. And he said that these lines were never exactly alike in the thumbs of any two human beings. In these days, we photograph the new criminal and hang his picture in the Rogues Gallery for future reference. But that Frenchman, in his day, used to take a print of the ball of a new prisoner's thumb and put that away for future reference. He always said that pictures were no good, future disguises could make them useless. The thumb's the only sure thing, apostrophe said he. You can't disguise that. Apostrophe and he used to prove his theory to, on my friends and acquaintances. It always succeeded. I went on telling fortunes. Every night I shut myself in, all alone, and studied the day's thumbprints with a magnifying glass. Imagine the devouring eagerness with which I pored over those mazy red spirals, with that document by my side which bore the right hand thumb and finger marks of that unknown murderer, printed with the dearest blood to me that was ever shed on this earth. And many a time I had to repeat the same old disappointed remark, will they never correspond? Apostrophe, apostrophe, but my reward came at last. It was the print of the thumb of the 43rd man of Company C whom I had experimented on, Private Franz Adler. An hour before, I did not know the murderer's name, or voice, or figure, or face, or nationality. But now I knew all these things. I believed I might feel sure, the Frenchman's repeated demonstrations being so good a warranty. Still, there was a way to make sure. I had an impression of Kruger's left thumb. In the morning I took him aside, when he was off duty, and when we were out of sight and hearing of witnesses, I said, impressively dash, a part of your fortune is so grave, that I thought it would be better for you, if I did not tell it in public. You and another man, whose fortune I was studying last night, Private Adler, have been murdering a woman and a child. You are being dogged. Within 5 days both of you will be assassinated. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he dropped on his knees, frightened out of his wits, and for 5 minutes he kept pouring out the same set of words, like a demented person, and in the same half-crying way which was one of my memories of that murderous night in my cabin, I didn't do it. Upon my soul I didn't do it, and I tried to keep him from doing it. I did, as God is my witness. He did it alone. Apostrophe, apostrophe, this was all I wanted. And I tried to get rid of the fool, but no, he clung to me, imploring me to save him from the assassin. He said, I have money, $10,000, hid away, the fruit of loot and thievery. Save me, tell me what to do, and you shall have it, every penny. 2/3 of it is my cousin Adler's, but you can take it all. We hid it when we first came here. But I hid it in a new place yesterday, and have not told him, shall not tell him. I was going to desert, and get away with it all. It is gold, and too heavy to carry when one is running and dodging. But a woman who has been gone over the river 2 days, to prepare my way for me is going to follow me with it. And if I got no chance to describe the hiding place to her, I was going to slip my silver watch into her hand, or send it to her, and she would understand. There's a piece of paper in the back of the case, which tells it all. Here, take the watch, tell me what to do. Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.